Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I almost feel like rather than reading this introduction of our first guest, I should sing it, but I will spare you this time. Rachel Bloom is the star, co-creator, and co-songwriter of the acclaimed TV musical dramedy series Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. Her work on the show earned her an Emmy for Outstanding Original Music and Lyrics and a Golden Globe for Best Performance by an Actress in a Television Series, Musical, or Comedy. But as she will tell you in her medium of choice, music videos, or excuse me, as she says often, music videos, she's not all about the accolades. She's about the art.
I don't care about award shows. They have nothing to do with art.
I'm so sorry.
I don't need to beg for some acclaim, to desperately build my fame. I write and sing and act to be a part of a community of people who value integrity. I don't care about award shows. I don't need the shallow praise. I don't have the inkling of a yen. I'd rather sit in my den, wearing black and reading ancient Grecian plays. All the world's a stage and all the men are only players. So why would a hunk of tin be in my prayers? I only pray about emotions or when to use a comma. And when I pray to Dionysus, the Greek god of drama. That's right, I pray to Greek gods. I'm classically trained. I don't care about award shows.
So feh on awards. Who needs them when you have a new book and a new baby? Rachel's new book of essays, poems, sketches, and musings is out now. It's titled I Want to Be Where the Normal People Are. In it, Rachel gives her candid and often hilarious take on mental health, her love of musical theater, and, well, as misogyny and comedy. Joining me now is Rachel Bloom. Hi, Rachel.
Wow, what an intro.
Well, I have to confess.
Thank you.
I'm a fan. I'm a bloomer. So I'm going to try to keep it together and be professional.
Oh, my God. Oh, I'm flattered. Well, it's so funny. It's so funny that that music video, I Don't Care About Award Shows, is all about, of course, not caring about award shows, when in fact it was made for our Emmy campaign.
I know.
You know, in season two, and it failed, did not work. I think that was the season that we got no Emmy nominations for anything. So that video backfired in its true purpose, but it's a great cover for my disappointment, obviously.
Your book is called I Want to Be Where the Normal People Are, a play on the lyrics of The Little Mermaid, and it's got this sort of Judy Blume-esque, Are You There, God, It's Me, Margaret, kind of cover vibe. What did you want to examine in this book about the word normal?
Well, first of all, I just have to say, two of my best friends are listening in New York right now. They texted me. I woke up to frantic texts from them this morning. This is their favorite show. Just want to shout out to Brendan and Jan. They wanted to say to you, Allison, that my gay husbands say they are massive fans of yours. That doesn't answer your question. That was probably boring for everyone else to listen to, but I had to shout them out because I haven't seen them and they haven't met my baby, and I miss New York, and I miss everyone in New York so much. And even hearing the scary pandemic New Jersey news on the local news while I was listening to go on, I was like, oh, I miss New York. Anyway, your question was about the word normal, yes?
It was.
Well, as I was writing the book, I kind of started with these foundational stories that had always been part of my self-narrative. And one of them is an incident in fifth grade, in which my fifth grade teacher told me, normal kids don't dress the way you do. And it was this traumatic, really important moment that stuck in my, I don't know, whatever the part of your brain that records exact memories when you're traumatized. I want to say it's the hippocampus, maybe
hypothalamus.
Hippocampus. There you go. So it stuck in my hippocampus. And I was writing that story, and I was kind of dancing around different titles for the book and themes for the book, and I realized, well, that's the core of what I want to say and what I want to talk about, is my feeling of being on the outside of things.
So much of the book is funny, but you're also looking at some tough times in your life and your childhood. What was something that you forgot about, that you stumbled upon, that surprised you?
Oh my God. So many things. I talk about in seventh grade, the popular kids paid the most popular guy to ask me out. And I was talking about that memory with my friend from seventh grade, and she reminded me that the place where the popular kids sat, the reason they sat there was because it was closest to the lunch line. And it brought back my fury of like, oh, right. I had to wait in line, but they would just rush out. They would get in line first, and then they'd immediately get to eat. And even just that fury of that they'd have 5 extra minutes at snack and lunch made me angry all over again.
In the book, you write about being an only child. It seems like you and your parents were super close growing up. But you also write that you were spoiled and you knew it, that you were an attention hound and you knew it. Now that you're a parent, how did writing this change the way you're thinking about your parenting? And your child's a wee one, tiny, tiny little person now.
Yeah, she's 8 months. I think that first of all, writing a book that was so immersed in childhood reminded me to never invalidate her emotions. That whatever she's feeling at the time, even if it's over something that I might think is silly, she's feeling those feelings. And I never want to mock her or laugh at her for feeling those things. I will strive to not do that. As our upbringings, even though we're growing up around the same place, are going to be quite different, because she's growing up the child of entertainers mm-hmm. and comedians. And so I am worried about the spoiled aspect if she is an only child, but I'm worried about, I don't want her to become one of those, you know, Hollywood kids who's just like insufferable to be around, and thinks that everyone drives Teslas, and thinks that, that they deserve praise and attention merely for being the child of someone important. I'm actively thinking about that. I want her to have a grounded middle class upbringing, closer to the way I grew up, actually.
You may have to come back to New York for that.
I mean, will Maybe. I though? Kids in New York?
Well, they're sophisticated, but, you know, the thing about L.A., and you're calling from L.A., somebody wanted to know, that I find
yes.
is a little bit weird, is that you really can create your own bubble, because you can go from your house to your car to the place you wanted to go, as opposed to in New York, you got to interact with other people at some point.
That's true, although my friend grew up very, very, very wealthy in New York, and so this is kind of an outlier, but she... Mm-hmm. Was told, when you get into a cab, you tell them exactly where you want to go. You tell them the exact route. And if they deviate, they're trying to kidnap you. And she was on the FDR. She said not to take the FDR. The cab driver took the FDR because it was quicker. She got out of the cab and rolled out of the cab, like action star style, in the middle of the FDR.
For real?
Yeah, for real. This actually happened.
Oh, I kind of want to meet that person. Wow. My guess is Rachel.
I will connect you.
My guess is Rachel Bloom. The name of her new book is I Want to Be Where the Normal People Are. You were a prolific writer as a kid, and the book is filled with poems and diary entries. What was fueling you to write as young Rachel?
What was my what?
What was fueling the writing? Like, what was making you sit down and...
Oh, my big emotions that I had nowhere to put them. My the feeling of being outside from being bullied, the anger I had, sadness I had, the misplaced lust that I had. A part of the book is erotic poetry that I wrote when I was around 11, 12. And I had nowhere to put these emotions, because growing up, especially where I did, when I did, this beautiful beach town, Manhattan Beach, people didn't talk about dark things. Mm-hmm. And why would you? The sun is shining. You could go surfing every day. There was, in fact, a surf PE option. Why would you talk about death and wondering if we're alone in the universe when, you know, you have these great burritos? And so I had nowhere to put these emotions in, except the page, if you will.
You do have these erotic poems that you include, and I'm not going to read them, but one includes the line, "Fireworks explode in our bodies." And there's such a time capsule. I mean, I think any woman reading it will remember that moment when you had, or young man, or whomever reads it and has that moment, that feeling. And they're really personal, and they're actually really sweet. What made you ultimately decide to include these poems, the erotic ones?
Well, in addition to feeling outside of the normal, the inverse of that is, what's a normal part of life that I don't ever hear talked about? And a big part of puberty for me was dealing with these big sexual feelings that no one ever really talked about or acknowledged, which makes sense. People, you know, grown people, when writing movies and TV, don't want to necessarily write about adolescent people as these burgeoning sexual beings, because that's weird, and I get it. But these were emotions that I had. And in fact, I based one of my music videos called "You Can Touch My Boobies," is based on my own feelings and erotic poetry that I wrote in my diary. I had to flip the genders so that I could be in the music video. Check it out on YouTube. But I just thought it was important, as long as we're talking about what's normal, that as I was writing this poetry, I think at the time I was like, this isn't normal. No one else is having feelings like this. I'm the only one feeling this way. But no, I think everyone around me was having these feelings and didn't know where to put them or what to do with them. We just weren't talking about it because it was embarrassing.
My guest is Rachel Bloom. The name of her new book is I Want to Be Where the Normal People Are. You're kind enough to read the section called How Can I Explain? I love these. This is a really short little chapter, but it's really, it explains a lot. Would you mind reading it, Rachel?
Yes. Ever since the brave Thespis stepped out of the chorus to become the world's first actor, people have been shouting back, "Yo, Thespis, why don't you play sports instead, you effing dork?" before throwing rotten spanakopita at him. In case it's not already apparent, I'm a theater kid. For most of my life, I loved everything about the theater, spelled theatry, if you're that guy. I loved that moment right before the house lights went down and the overture started, the ecstatic rush of watching a good tap number set on a boat, the moment Mimi almost dies in Roger's arms, but then she comes back to life and they sing a reprise of There's Only Us, and you're like, OMG, yes, I knew she couldn't die, I knew it. And of course, I loved the attention. Oh boy, did I really love the attention. But the thing I loved most about the theatry was that being a theatry kid was an easy explanation for the reason I didn't fit in. It meant that I was a cultured and misunderstood eccentric whose interests made me wise beyond my years. I never had to actually question my actions, my choices, or the deeper reasons for my unhappiness. Being a theater kid simply meant my problems were all caused by it, being me versus everyone else. Even when I did plays in the form of rinky-dink children's community theater productions, I was with other kids who did theater, but weren't theater kids, you know? They didn't live and breathe theater like me. I remember one pretty girl in one of those plays talking backstage about the highlights she just got in her hair at a local salon, and I thought, what a phony, popular bee. Get out of here. You don't need the theater, and it doesn't need you. This narrative had to shift when I did befriend other actual theater kids. Finding my fellow diehards through my high school theater department and summer teen theater productions was great, but it meant I had to rejigger the way I blamed theater for all my problems. Now I told myself that theater was my life, and everything else had to be secondary to it. My studies hadn't slipped because I had some fundamental problems staying focused in school. I'd just rather be rehearsing. I even had a shirt that said, "I'd rather be rehearsing," and the necklace, and the jacket, and the bag, and the socks, and a backup shirt. I was constantly tired, not because I had trouble regulating my sleep and setting boundaries for myself. I was just a night owl meant to be sipping martinis at Sardi's while everyone else was snoozing. And that's it.
The best. So, after the break, we'll hear more about what happens when a theater kid writes a book. Of course, she includes a musical in it. Rachel Bloom stays with us. We'll be right back. This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. My guest is Rachel Bloom. The name of her new book is I Want to Be Where the Normal People Are. So we explained earlier, Rachel, and you read that great passage, but there are poems in the book, there are sketches, and then there's this musical plopped right in the middle of the book, shows up mid-book. And it's a musical about your relationship with musicals. How would you describe your relationship with musicals? And when did you write this?
Yeah, so it's actually right after the passage that I read, and it's a musical called "How Can I Explain a Truncated Explanation." I'm doing the chapter from memory. I think it's a truncated explanation of my relationship with musicals that glosses over some things, but gives you the general idea. So my relationship with musicals is it's like any long relationship. It's loaded. It has a lot of baggage. It has high ups, low downs, and it's something it's a relationship that I'm still in. She and I have been married for quite some time, and I knew I wanted to talk about it because it's an important part of my life, and also an important part if we're talking about normalcy. Even, you'd think that the not normal part of me is being interested in musicals, but actually I feel like I'm an outlier. Or I used to feel like that I was an outlier, even with being a theater kid, because my relationship with musicals is so kind of like complex and at times love-hate. And I started, I think, maybe writing it as an essay, and it just felt like very, I don't know, straightforward.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote the book, the type of book that I'd want to read. And I was like, well, I'm talking about musicals. Why don't I just write it as a musical? And so that's what I did. And it was a delight to write.
And if you go to your website, people can actually hear the musical. So let's play a little clip of this musical. This is Rachel Bloom.
What's this? Our school's beloved drama and English teacher is starting a year-round musical theater class? Wow, I'll finally get to spend all of my time doing theater instead of just little community productions in the summer? This class sounds amazing!
A happy waltz begins and the Gaskins re-enter.
Because that teacher said theater is cool. Its existence will now be tolerated in the school. This class is now the hippest place to be. So we will all respect the people who get the least. Acting, singing, dancing, what a thrill. But what loser would have had the time to hone all those skills?
Rachel raises her hand enthusiastically. This bit.
You can go to racheldoesstuff.com to hear the whole thing. You went to the prestigious NYU Tisch School for the Arts, but you write in the book that you became disenchanted with musical theater as a whole. What did it feel like to have that moment when you thought, you know what, this maybe isn't going to be, for me, traditional musical theater?
It was devastating because it was my whole narrative. I think any interest, any kid who has like a passion mm-hmm. when they're young and you tell yourself this story, I'm going to be this thing and I'm going to be defined by this thing. And then you run into an obstacle with that. It's scary because your entire sense of self is rocked. And at the time it was a combination of, I still had a lack of sleep discipline. So I was coming to class first of all, very tired, and it was a very hard conservatory program. So I think that's at the core of some of it. But also, I felt like I didn't fit in. A lot of my fellow students knew each other. They did the Tisch Summer High program, which I didn't do. A lot of them were East Coasters who went to places like Stage Door together. I didn't go there. And a lot of them were like just more talented than I was. They had better voices. They had better technique. They were like better actors. And that's really, really, really scary when you're the lead in the school plays and that's what you got. And you tell yourself, well, that's what I'm meant to be. Maybe I'm not happy in all these other aspects, but at least I'm the lead in school plays, and at least I'm the most talented. And that's also an only child thing. I'm the you know, center of the world. And then also, around the time I got to school, I got on a sketch comedy group, and I fell in love with sketch comedy writing, and I started learning about the technique of writing. And in doing that, I realized a lot of musicals that I liked, that I especially thought were funny, weren't funny. And so it was this kind of, at all sides, this disenchantment with musical theater was coming at me, but the datedness of the writing being a huge factor.
In the book, you talk about your life in New York City, and you have this sort of resume of jobs that you've had that I think that will resonate with a lot of creative people and actors and folks who are listening. You're a singing waitress on the Spirit of New York and the Spirit of New Jersey dinner cruises, a reservationist in a fine dining establishment, a telemarketer. You worked at Max Brenner in Union Square. What did you learn from all of these jobs working in New York that, you know, is still with you today, that's still part of your hustle?
God, thank you for that question. First of all, what I love about day jobs is that you are with people and that you work with people who you otherwise would have never met or worked with. Because it's not the same as being at a job related to like your career or even your interests, where you're kind of around people and people may have different backgrounds, but you're around people who have the same interests. But I met just so many different kinds of people. And so I think that, especially when you're writing and you're writing characters, I still to this day draw on the well of people that I met working those jobs. And I think that we're all just trying to get by. Yeah, I met people who had very different opinions that I did. I worked at this summer camp one summer. I was a counselor, but it was like adult counselors. It was kind of weird. And there was one guy there who was like a conservative Christian who would kind of always tell me I was going to hell, but was otherwise like a really funny person. And it just taught me to not demonize people whose opinions and experiences are different from my own. Because we're all working to try to sell the chocolate at Max Brenner. At the end of the day, we just got to sell the chocolate.
My guest is Rachel Bloom. Her new book is called I Want to Be Where the Normal People Are. I want to talk about Crazy Ex-Girlfriend a little bit. In a minute, we'll talk about how the show came to be. But one of the things I really have always liked about the show, and I watch it from beginning to end, and I watch it in real time, too. That was part of what I used to...
Whoa!
Yeah, I actually... this is funny. I actually tweeted once, I'm in a car coming back from the airport. This person better hurry up so I can go get to Crazy Ex-Girlfriend at the right time. And it was really funny because your co-creator, Aileen, favorited it. And I was like, oh, they're watching. Anyway, so...
We see so many... Oh, Aileen and I, like, when the show was airing, we saw so many tweets. We sometimes went on the Reddit. I think anyone who has a TV show is like looking at the mentions and the reviews and stuff, even if they claim they're not. It's too alluring not to. Yeah.
But I really liked about the show, and I thought was really smart and really careful about the show, was that you really, you know, by the end of it, we realize it really is about this woman's mental health. And, you know, it's been fun and silly and cheeky and snarky along the way, but it's really has an important message about mental health. Did it start out that way? Was that always part of your master plan? Or was it something that sort of evolved as you got into this and saw this platform?
Well, the show was always meant to be, you know, the reverse mirrored image of a rom-com. And it was always about Rebecca's happiness. I'll spoil the show, so close your ears. But, like, from the beginning of the pitch, she always didn't quote-unquote, end up with a guy. That was inherent in the show. So, but as far as the specific diagnosis and the direct tackling of mental health, it kind of, it was always there, but it grew more and more as we made the show. And we certainly didn't start the show knowing that we were going to tell the story of someone with borderline personality disorder. That was something that grew. We were kind of writing it by instinct and feel in the beginning. We were writing her based on not only experiences that I had had with my mental health and that Aline had had or known people to have, but also we were taking the tropes of rom-coms and exaggerating them and then kind of backing ourselves into, okay, well, if this person is actually going to do this thing, if she's going to, you know, move somewhere to be with someone, which is kind of a rom-commy premise, but we want to take that seriously, she would have to be tremendously unhappy to do that. So as the show's kind of, it's almost like the structure dictated Rebecca's mental state.
When the show was, there's a great story in the book, and I don't want to give too much of it away, about how the show actually made it to the CW. Were you surprised that this got on the air? I know you loved it and you knew it was creative and interesting and all that, but it was really outside the boundaries of what had been on network TV before.
Yeah, I was really surprised. Especially because, and I talk about it in the book, but it was a Showtime pilot, which made sense. And then it was passed on, which was unfortunate. And then we sent it to all the other cable networks and they passed. So I was really mourning the show. And the meeting we had with the CW was kind of like this last Hail Mary. And in the meeting, they were like, well, we might consider it for midseason. And I remember thinking like, okay, whatever, sure. Mm-hmm. And it was only when I found out the CW wasn't happy with any of their pilots that came in for the fall and that we were being considered for the fall days before they had to announce what was coming in the fall, that it started to feel real. And in fact, I want to say it was like a day or two after I got the phone call, we were ordered to series. I flew to New York to announce the show. So it was quite fast. And I was definitely playing emotional catch up as it was happening. It happened too quickly for me to react in real time emotionally, which is probably good. Because I think if I'd felt all of the things that I, you know, should have been feeling, like, oh my God, I have a TV show. Oh my God, I'm nominated for a Golden Globe. It might have, like, my head might have exploded.
My guest is Rachel Bloom. The name of her book is I Want to Be Where the Normal People Are. For anybody who follows you on social media, you're so open. When you were pregnant, you were showing on Instagram pictures of you in your underwear. There's a video now of you with a tour of your house and your pretty baby blue piano and little Oinky, the nuclear pig thing you got when you were 12. So people know a lot about you, and you've had a tough year. You had a great year because you're a child. You've had a tough year because your dear friend passed away from COVID, your collaborator. During the course of this year, what did you do for yourself so that you could hold grief and joy at the same time? Because I bet there's a lot of people having this experience as well.
Yeah. It was a mix of, like, just being present in the profoundness, because I think mourning someone while holding new life in my arms, being, first of all, very on the nose of the universe, I didn't have to try, actually, to feel that profundity. If anything, sometimes it was, like, too real. It was almost like for a couple weeks I'd taken too many mushrooms, and I just, like, needed to come down, and I, you know, it was like everything, it's too weird, real, it's too much. And so the self-care I exhibited was like listening to comedy podcasts. I just needed to feel I mean, for lack of a better word, like normal mm-hmm. again. And I think there's a quote by Christopher Hitchens, and I'm gonna butcher it, but it's something like comedy, laughing is our way of like laughing at our own mortality. Mm-hmm. There is something about just distracting yourself with something that's funny for funny's sake, that suddenly you don't think about the overwhelming, like, I don't know, infinity of the universe, which is just so apparent when you give birth. You think about your own life, you think about the context of time, you think, oh my God, this is someone who, if all goes right, they will outlive me. And so you're already kind of thinking about your own mortality, and then obviously grieving during that is just, it's a lot. It's just overwhelming. So comedy podcasts really help me.
This is almost an unfair question to ask somebody who's got an 8-month-old, but are you working on a new musical? Is the internet right?
Well, I've been working on The Nanny, but, you know, Broadway musicals are a very, like, it's a slow process. So, like, working on, I mean, like, we are still in the writing phases of it, even in the fastest. It's funny because I was co-writing the music for The Nanny with Adam Schlesinger, my writing partner who passed away. And but I remember he has another musical that was about to come to the Atlantic, Bedwetter, which is based on Sarah Silverman's book, and he co-wrote it with Sarah Silverman, and he was so frustrated with how slow the process of making a musical was, because he was simultaneously with working on that stage musical, working on our show, where we would write a musical number, and then a week and a half later, we'd film it, mm-hmm. and it would be on TV a month or two after that. So the opposite of the Broadway development, where you write something and then, you know, people finally see it like 8 years later after a million workshops or whatever. So I'm working on that. I have some other, and then I have some other movies and pitches I'm working on. But definitely my ambition hasn't slowed down, but my actual time to do the things has, because I want to, you know, spend time with my little larva.
My guest has been Rachel Bloom. The name of her book is I Want to Be Where the Normal People Are. Hello to your husbands. Thank you so much for listening. And Rachel, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. You are awesome.
This is Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI, to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.